Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, coming to you live from just outside Washington, D.C., in my own little coyote witchery, welcoming my first in-person guest here at the temple. This is all very auspicious, as it is for all of us, as Jupiter, the intelligence of blessing and story stations right now. You know, inward resumes forward motion tomorrow, which is outward. So what a great time to cahoot with the larger forces to spiral blessing and liberating woof out into the world and to supplant the toxic mimic of theater with actual theater. And for bonus points, it's a full moon in Sagittarius, which is Jupiter's sign, again, spiraling it forth. Wonderful short clip that we're not going to play, but again, wonderful person who said, "Fearmongers are more dangerous than terrorists. You know, they set things going. It's like the fly in the bull's ear that destroys the China shop. It is our reactions to it that ripple through the world and create mayhem." And he said, "The theater captures our imagination, and governments react in this overreaction. So if we allow our imaginations to be captured, but if we free our imaginations," and I thought that's why we're having this week's guest on. We are welcoming Yahya Lababidi, Egyptian-American poet, as Jupiter, the power of journey and blessing, is stationing to resume its forward motion at this full moon, agent of liberating blessing, dedicated to the poet as guide to global citizenship. He says the language of love is the language of tolerance, and author of many, many things that we will uncover, but also the forthcoming Where Epics Fail. Welcome, Yahya.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn.
Ah, a little close. There we go.
Thank you for having me.
That's pretty good.
I'm glad to be had.
Okay. I think we can hear you.
Okay,
that's good. But yes, close in. That's good. All right, wonderful. This is all an experiment, as everything should be. So yes, we connected through serendipity and kismet, and you first showed me your fabulous video on aphorisms where epics fail, right?
Yes, ma'am. So this is around 10 years in the making. It's aphorisms that I've been writing, overhearing myself, having conversations in response to what's happening in the world outside and the world within.
That's great. And I did say again, yes, the power of condensed thinking, you know, the aphorisms, the distilled. And as we were just briefly meeting backstage here, I go, "Ooh, you are Libra like myself, two Libras convening at this auspicious time, incarnations of Venus. We who have come to make the world more beautiful, may it be so." But as you were speaking and your dedication to craft and language, I go, "Virgo, you have planets in Virgo." And you go, "No, Virgo, terrible." I go, no, we want to decolonize our minds on all levels. It's the Hermes realm, the power of language and precise language. I bet you do. And then I pulled up your chart, and like me, you are Libra with the moon in Virgo. I knew it. We love it when it turns out that way. So, yeah, the power of language. I love, just to weave a little context, you are author of Balancing Acts, poems from 1993 to 2015. You speak of your rich cultural background, Rumi, Kierkegaard, Dickinson, growing up in a rich literary salon with Arabic luminaries coming through so deeply. So are you a cross-pollinating agent?
I hope. My goodness, yes. Cross-pollinating is huge. I was lucky to grow up in a household where the arts were welcome. I had poets, philosophers, thinkers, when I didn't know what that meant in my home as a kid. And I was maybe serving them drinks, maybe just receiving them. I don't know how old I was. I didn't know I was implicated in this task or journey till later on, till my late teens. But cross-pollinating, huge, huge word, good word.
And let's, so for mysterious reasons, and I'm so delighted to have you here, I've always had this aesthetic affinity with the Middle East for no clear reason. The yearning. Mm. You know, even in the call to prayer, I go, it's so, as a little girl, I was like, that's so beautifully full of yearning.
Mm.
And the Arabian Nights going, it's gotta have been okay for women at some point. The Arabian Nights full of women redeemers, right? And,
you know, this is, I mean, I'm going to start where I think you're going, but let's say that given the long fabled history that we've had, whether we being Egyptians or the Middle East in general, I have to see this particular moment as what the French call a mauvais quart d'heure, a bad quarter of an hour. If you're thousands of years old, this has got to be a hiccup. This has got to not define who you are. At least this is how I see it. I grew up in Egypt. Not the Egypt, I've been away for 11 years, so not the Egypt that is that I see now in the news, and even then I don't quite know if quite the news can be relied upon. But I think everywhere seems to be in a place of change. Or, I mean, certainly in America, my new home, that's not the America I came to university to attend some 20 years ago. That's another America. Europe, likewise. So we accept that everything is transitioning, and maybe we can participate in that transition positively.
Right. Well, you speak of your love of the color lavender. Oh, we're in good shape, bringing in more light, you know, and philosophy, mind-based aphorisms and brevity, and the role of the poet at a time of crisis, you know, and to spiral. Well, I love a wonderful, my Syrian guide and friend who lived there for many years, Deborah Felma, saying, remember, salam and shalom does not mean the absence of war. It's the presence of oneness.
Mm.
So the poet also invoking oneness.
Mm.
But where I wanted to, and then your precision, where I wanted to toss it back to you, yeah, that we're in this riptide, right, of, you know, ancient meeting modern, American meeting foreign, you know, everything, and there can be demonic aspects, but wonderful aspects of this cross-pollination. And I guess where I want to toss it back to you also, this issue, the important assignment of refugees. And having spent some hugely influential time in Syria, saying if only we could have, Americans could have Bedouin manners. Because the Bedouin the Bedouin greeting is, you know, strangers, how wonderful.
Yeah.
Hello, come this way, you shall have coffee and things. And if we were to become Bedouin, we would say, oh, you must have endured so much. You must have traveled so far. You must have so many stories to tell. They must be the stories we need.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that I think is missing. This idea of the high side. It's easy to sort of reduce a culture to a caricature, or see only, you know, the demonic, or in this case, you know, the terrorist. You should be afraid. Be very afraid of those hairy barbarians. Yes, be afraid of those hairy barbarians, but they do not represent the rest of that culture with its nuance and sophistication and ancient wisdom.
Mm.
So it's a pity to see that loss, to see, you know, a few thousands, let's say, sabotage 1.7 billion of the Muslim tradition to begin with. Or Egypt, for that matter, the Egypt that I know, that I grew up in, that I see now, and I think that's not quite who we are. And I think this idea of giving people the benefit of the doubt, whether you're an American or an Egyptian or somewhere in between, saying we're better than this because we've been better than this and we can be again. It's good to remind people of their high side.
Well, in a poem I heard you read on, it was addressing terrorism. And you bring up the important point, certainly in the hearts of many of our dedicated listeners, of anything that's anywhere is everywhere. America has messed in the elections, you know, overthrowing, you know, Mossadegh, even back earlier in the teens, when Churchill put an end to the democratic movement in Iran. I mean, but constant messing. And so we go, right, complexity of story, where I think I was going with the Scheherazade thing, was also this idea of being able to hold many stories at once.
Sure, sure. I mean, I think it's not, we talk about our interconnectedness and how we are all well together, and if there's an illness in the larger body, then we're all affected. But I mean, this is something that we feel very much now. If there is, let's say, an imbalance somewhere, then we are all feeling it. Then, you know, if someone is suffering because of, let's say, greed or dictatorship, and certainly dictatorship that we are involved in the U.S. with upholding, then it comes back. So this idea of thinking that, you know, America first is great, take care of yourself first is great, if in case of emergencies, put the mask on your face before you help others is great, but realize that the others are there, and especially if you've been in any way involved in their affairs and in their fates, then you're part of that. Then you're part of the good and the bad. You can't afford to distance yourself from it and pretend that one is one is free that way.
Well, yes, absolutely. The oneness that we're all complicitous.
We certainly are.
You know, and terrorism, what we call terrorism, and tyranny are completely complicitous. They need each other. So perhaps, you know, in your beautiful work and what you inspire us to do too, we're sucking the chi out of our complicitous chi out of the snookered colonial undesirable story, yeah, right? And exhaling it into a better vision. Yeah.
Also, in a very kind of simple, perhaps crude way, this notion of terrorism is a great imbalance, a gross imbalance.
Yeah.
You've got these corrupt leaders. I'll begin with my part of the world. In back where I come from, in the Middle East, in Egypt, etc. Where you have corrupt leadership, that enables this type of terrorism. And then in turn, you've got these corrupt leaders pointing to them and saying, "Oh, look, because of these terrorists, we must continue to exist and deprive you of your rights and have emergency laws." This is what I grew up with. I mean, in Egypt before Mubarak, we were under emergency law for 30 years. The majority of the population in Egypt are under 30 years old. They knew nothing but Mubarak. You know, so it's all unfortunate, is what it is.
Well, who is the wonderful Egyptian comedian who was booted out? Has come to America. You know, starts with a B. And he does. Oh, anyway, he's your compatriot. I apologize. But he's like, "Oh, America, you're just little baby tyrants. Let us teach you some Egypt."
Yeah, yeah. There you go.
You're just beginning to understand the full thumbprint. This is amateur, thuggish, cartoonish. You can address it, but we really have.
Should have the name, but he's a doctor, and his name is Bassem something.
Yes, Bassem. That's right. All praise to Bassem. That's
the,
right.
The Egyptian, yes. John Stewart. That was one of his. One of his.
Right.
Titles.
And this theme, I don't know, anecdotal. I like anecdotal of Egyptian men that I know who were doctors who then were like, "No, I'm going to go guide in the Sinai. Hello, Dr. Rabia. No, I'm a doctor. No, I'm going to be the Egyptian John Stewart." A different kind of doctor,
yeah.
a culture doctor, right? So, I love that. You know that. Where I think I was also going with Scheherazade is what I've always loved about the quality of medicine of the Middle East, and perhaps that the colonizer, the oppressor, needs the medicine of what he's colonizing or oppressing, that England needed the metaphysic of India, but America needs the beauty and culture of the Middle East and the manners. And
manners is nice because it's manners, one of those words that people think of as a superficial quality. And manners, if you take it from an Islamic concept, if you talk about adab, is very profound, is not a superficial quality. It's much more to do with morals and virtues than it is to do with a kind of finishing school politeness. And you talk about medicine, and I walk into your cave of marvels here. You really should see it, dear listener. But on the way in, there was Jung, among many other masters. And this morning, just this morning, maybe it was yesterday, but I think it was this morning, this notion of the wounded physician, only the wounded physician heals. There's something to be said for that also, for the great sufferer. because of, you know, politics and injustice and, you know, economic hardship, the great sufferer is in position of privilege if they only know it, if they can sort of stay focused and not afraid and alarmed and recognize the great wealth they have to take the suffering and let it, you know, turn it into vision.
Yes, right. Turn it into medicine, because then they're not the martyr. Again, it's part of the themes I've been so loving to play with and proffer, which is better a trickster than a martyr, and the distinction is both take on the unconscious poison of family and culture, and the martyr takes that and goes, now I've spoken truth to power, and now I'm in prison.
Can I interrupt you for a moment?
Please.
I must interrupt you for a moment, because I was telling you earlier that I saw something of yours, but I couldn't remember where you spoke, etc. But a couple of things marked me, and I couldn't remember them, and now I can.
Okay.
You held up a cup, an imaginary cup. You had a story to go with it of poison. It was a saint.
Yes.
I think it was St. Patrick,
it
possibly.
It was, yes, exactly.
And it wasn't the typical story of St. Patrick, because why would you offer the typical story of St. Patrick? And you held up the cup, and somehow the poison had floated to the surface, and you were blowing the poison off the top and consuming the rest of it. There's something there. There's something great there, if one were to take...
Well, you do. Yeah. That's what you do with your poetry. Right. It is the apocryphal story of St. Patrick. We like multiple stories, and to the creatively suspicious part of all of us going, there's got to be more.
Mm-hmm.
Again, in the mystery play. But yeah, St. Patrick is invited to a wine testing dinner, given a cup of poisoned wine. He holds the... See, he does not do it in angry. He doesn't die, and he doesn't throw it down in righteous.
No, that's cheap. That's low. Right,
exactly.
That's unimaginative.
Right. He holds it up to the light, and the poison rises to the top, and he blows it off like froth on a Guinness. Wha! And he quaffs the drink and toasts everyone, including those who tried to poison him, causing the elders to go, ah, a real initiate, right? Yeah. So maybe, can we go, that's the poet's task?
So a flip version of that, because you're talking about the top, the bottom rising to the top, a flip version of that would be Rumi advising that perhaps you're searching in the branches for what exists in the roots. So rather than this sort of alarmist state where everyone is in a state of panic and great mistrust of everyone else, perhaps looking at the roots rather than the branches. It's easy to look at the branches, and it's easy to find fault with the branches. It takes more time, and certainly humility and care, to examine the root of the problems. And I think if people look at the root of the problems, and I when I say that, I'm not in any way discounting my part of the world. I think one of the first things that one has to say, let's say to begin with as a Muslim, is that there is a need for housekeeping. Even if it's a few thousand that are upsetting the balance of the nearly 2 billion, there's a need for housekeeping. But also across the world, you know, what is at the root of the problem, not the branches?
Definitely. Well, you brought it up. You've solved it already. Which I just heard a great snippet on radio about how corruption is the root of terrorism. You know, if your sister must sleep with the magistrate to have her case heard, if the whatever, and see, here comes the power of story that we're convening all of us on right now. And someone comes along and goes, they are, you know, we will have a society where that level of corruption does not exist. We want to be invited to a better story.
Sure.
And when I was visiting your homeland, you born in Cairo, Dr. Rabia, may he be praised, as we were driving out to Wadi Nitram, you know, Valley of Salt, said, you know, here's where thousands of years ago the peasants were mining salt for the pharaohs, and the Christianity, Coptic Christianity, came along and said, we have a better story for you and some food.
Mm.
And the peasants go, that is a better story.
Mm.
And now that wanes, and now the Muslim Brotherhood comes along and goes, we have a better story, right?
Yeah.
So it is, you know, it behooves all of us, and the cultivated, dedicated poet crafters like yourself, to come up with the true better story.
Egypt is complicated. I mean, Egypt, it pains me to see the story of the Coptic of the Coptic Egyptian, because one can say that they are directly connected to our pharaonic ancestry before, let's say, the Muslim Egyptian. So it was hard enough for them under Mubarak, and it's just gotten harder. It's one of those things where, you know, they're more sinned against than sinning. They can really do no wrong at this point. It's really painful to see this exodus out of the Middle East of Christians, because I'm also half Lebanese, and my Lebanese side, half of government is Christian. So you'd have, you know, the vice president be one, and the president is another religion, and so on and so forth. And it used to be that you wouldn't even, it was a non-issue. You wouldn't ask someone what their religion was. You wouldn't ask someone where they came from, because it was a country that relied on tourism and relied on others and welcomed them. And it's sad to see us diminished in this way and diminishing ourselves. So
now or later, but what would be a... If magic is with us,
and it is, and that's why we're here.
That's right. And if we entertain that possibility again for everybody, Jupiter stationing, what well wishing against all odds would we like to
remember?
To waft into the world.
To remember.
All right, you take remembering first.
To remember. Remembrance is, if we're going to return to the Muslim tradition, which I seem to find myself apologetically, compulsively returning to. Remembrance is huge. Remembrance, this idea of not forgetting to give praise, to honor, to recognize what is holy, but also remembering what you're capable of. And I think we've forgotten our ancient wisdom. I mean, it's terrific that people want to visit us from all over the world to see what we are capable of, but we also should remember what we are capable of, and we should nurture that. And not sabotage ourselves. And I'm talking as an Egyptian here. And you, listener, can apply it to yourself and see how you're sabotaging your ancient wisdom.
Until now. No, but that's perfect. That's perfect. You're speaking the sky-earth story so beautifully. Because right now, it really is the moment of reflecting on the guiding wisdom traditions with which we're all assigned by aesthetic affinity, you know, and to bring it, you know, we need everything now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and to bring the ancient with full respect alive in a fresh vernacular way.
Yeah.
So here's your poet self translating wisdom into vernacular.
Well, I think the artist has that role among others, but I think this idea of sort of remembering the ancient wisdom, nudging. People know they've just forgotten. The artist comes along and says, hey, how about this? You know, take a look at this. Remember this. You know, maybe this will nudge you along. I think Egypt is somewhere, for example, that is very much in touch with its history, because you go there and people are living in the tombs, or they're living, you know, with their ruins, and I mean, it's there. You have it before you. You don't need, I mean, these are symbols, but you also can do this in other ways. People just need reminders, I think is what they need.
Yeah, well, and maybe it's, you know, again, we are tentative and inviting in manners and respect, but, you know, what could be the good of American interaction with the Middle East? What, you know, when I was in Syria with Deborah Felmuth, and I still love the aesthetic, and everywhere we went, in Palmyra, all these places when they were still okay, and everywhere we went, people were like, let's dress you as a Bedouin, wop, 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 wop. And I love the irony and humor. I remember Saeed saying, you do look like a Bedouin, and Deborah saying, you do look like a Bedouin, but your face is very soft, you know? And Saeed saying, I tell you what, you get up at dawn, walk till dusk, soon you have the complete look.
Yeah.
But so I would be dressed, you know, by friends in traditional garb, and we went to these beautiful restaurants in Damascus, and all these beautiful Arab women would come up in Western dress going, we used to dress like that, but you make it look hip. Anyway, so I'm going, oh, just, you know, and a little bit, you know, just where's the positive liberating?
Well, there's a lot of positivity. Yeah. I mean, growing up, I went to American schools. I went to American schools since I was a kid. I spoke probably English at around the same time I spoke Arabic. And I was exposed to, you know, my teachers were Americans, British, etc. All the kids were from all over the world. Americans were the big friendly giant when I was growing up. You know, everyone knew about Dallas or, you know, it was bizarre, you know. Your camel was named Michael Jackson.
Right, I mean, yes, exactly.
So America is this, you know, this brilliant teenager, this, hormonally very well-developed teenager that did great good for themselves in the world. But the teenager, you know, this could also become, you know, the big friendly giant could crush you.
Glumpy.
Yeah. So it's a matter of balance, and it's a matter also of putting, it's this historical gaze where you think, okay, you know, maybe older civilizations, and we won't go to the Middle East, let's go to the Brits, for example, you know, or the Chinese or the Greek or the Indians. That's part of it. The rise and fall is part of it. So rather than, you know, fall flat on your face because of overweening pride, you know, anticipate the moment and sort of bow with understanding to the just to the fact that you are young and there are others who've been around.
No, I love that. When I was in Turkey, I did love saying to our wonderful guide, excuse us, we are a very young and childish people. We know nothing of other people's history.
But prodigies, but young who have done well for themselves, you know.
Well, yes.
Yes.
It is a complex brew that we're throwing everything, you know, into the cauldron, going where, you know, to bubble away all that might be.
Also, if I can just make a point, I grew up with the understanding that your government and the people are two. So, for example, if our government, you know, if our president came on television or any of his goons, you just sort of turned down the volume. You knew everything he said would be a lie. You didn't waste your time. It wasn't until I came here that people were so identified with their government that to critique the government was sacrilegious. You know, you can critique because you want more for the country that you represent, for the people that you love. Critiquing is not blasphemous. On the contrary, it's a patriotic act, you know, I think.
No. Yeah. Diagnosis leads to healing.
No,
there's a critical insight. And then what goes with fine analysis also is something that you have expressed, you know, the ecstatic traditions. And to get drunk, maybe not, on, as you say, on wine, but on virtue, like Rumi. We're going to have a very short break in about a minute and whatever, something. But we can start on ecstasy, right? I love that the word ecstatic means to stand outside, right? Ecstasis. So when people go, oh, they don't treat me with respect, I'm outsider, you go, that's because you're ecstatic. Mm. Anyway, but
ecstasy is huge. I've since my late teens, I would say that's something I've held in very high regard. I would visit, as a young man in my early 20s, the monasteries in Egypt, because I thought there was something there. I wanted to stay there. I would go there hoping they would accept me. Now, I wasn't prepared to necessarily pray as they pray, but I respected the tradition. I respected the silence, the solitude, the thanksgiving, and I got to see one of their great hermits being brought in after weeks of being in a cave speaking in tongues. So ecstasy, I think I'm still working with as a poet, in utter humility, recognizing it's not ours. Ecstasy is when you've been good and working very hard and you're just gifted something or other that's beyond your reach, as I understand it. I don't think the poetry is mine. I don't think the aphorisms are mine.
Ah, they come in.
I think you pave the way for them. You ready yourself to receive them, but they're not yours. When I was 19, maybe, I read Rimbaud's line about too bad for the wood that finds itself a violin. I is another.
We're going to come right back on this theme of ecstasy and how we can be participate in inviting, you know, redemptive healing into the cuckoo world with wonderful guest Egyptian-American poet Yahya Lababidi. This is Caroline Casey, Visionary Activist Show, and we'll be right back after this very short inspirational Taj break.
She took the consolation that dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellation that dazzled him across his eyes. She showered his head with quasar and made his tortoise cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Grab my indigo skyship, make its voyage long.
Get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. And as Jupiter stations and all of us get ready to waft, you know, trickster liberating blessings into the world, our more than perfect guest is Yahya Lapavidi, Egyptian-American poet. We are addressing the importance, the thing that changes, see, the martyr into the trickster is ecstatic invitation. And he is author of many things, but also the forthcoming Where Epics Fail, Aphorisms. So I want us to continue on ecstasy.
Right? Huge. That's right. That's everything.
Oh, okay, that's great. And then I love the relationship of ecstasy and aphorisms. But ecstasy, huge, everything, right? Again, the Sufi poets, the mystics, your embrace of the best of all culture. You're having moved from being an existentialist to a mystic, an intellectual mystic, which is a perfect thing. But anyway, so I love that part. So yes, wherever you want to go with that.
Okay, so since you mentioned that you allow me a way in. Growing up, I was very taken in a kind of reactionary way by the existentialists. I was surrounded by a kind of religiosity that I thought was too loud, too showy, and thus false. I'd get in a cab and he'd have the Quran blaring, and then at the same time he would be, you know, making a pass at an underage girl and he'd rip me off. And I thought, not consistent, at least philosophically. So my response as a teen, was, I want nothing to do with all of this. Throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I went all the way in the direction of Nietzsche and his ilk. I still respect Nietzsche a great deal in the sense of listening to you. I keep wanting to say a Nietzsche quote where he says, everything is a matter, everything is a dispute of taste and tasting. I think there's elegance there and a certain vulgarity of spirit that you wouldn't permit yourself if one acknowledged this truth as governments, nations, etc. So, fast forward 20 years later, and I find myself doubting my doubt, and sort of returning through the back door to a faith that I thought I didn't know how to begin to utter, and it was really the Sufi mystics that spoke to me. By way of Christian mystics, Jewish mystics, the Tao, and very much so now, this is what I would say is the sustenance that I find and the inspiration for my writing is mystical utterance, and specifically Sufi writing.
Right, and the realm of the spiritual adventure that you say, you know, again, I think, you know, there's that great biological phrase, ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny. I only know it because my mean older siblings made me act it out in charades a long time ago. But it means the growth of the organism contains the entire evolutionary history. And I think philosophies like that, too, you know, I went through an existential religion's a crutch and a fudge. Exactly. Well, it's a necessary, exactly as you say, a response to the garish, superstitious.
Yeah.
Tyranny that orthodoxy tends to degrade into, but I'll have to say it was entheogenically assisted mysticism, which made me again go patterns within, patterns without, Persian carpets. Oh wait, this is fantastic! I will become an astrologer and set forth. But I think that's also important that we include, you know, that's why, you know, the secular critic, you know, holds up the mirror and goes, yeah, which we need. And then with the wave of the hand, the trickster or poet, you know, turns the mirror into a window. Mm. Look, how, and then
turns the mirror into a window. This was my thought before I came to see you. Mm. Michel Foucault, a philosopher that I have a very complicated relationship with, who says, my work is to turn the wall into a window.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So this idea of seeing through, which works with ecstasy as another way of speaking, I think there's a point where you come to the sort of the end of the tether and you realize that it's not on your own that you can you know, break on through to the other side. So I think there's humility there too. Philosophy has its boundaries. And it's a tool, it's a training, and then poetry is very good at teaching you that you know, you can strain all you like, but you can't strain for vision or clarity. It's gifted you.
Right. Well, I love that. You speak of again, you know, you, in other interview, how you prepare to invite in the poems.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think I really want to take less and less credit for the writing. I think what one can do as a hapless tailor is to take the material you're presented with and know what to do with it. But it's really your whole day. It's your whole being. It's your entity that you're working with and trying to ready for this to receive, really. And so. So when I'm asked sort of what is my ritual or what is my work is to be worthy of my work.
Excellent. And how we first began this dance to radio was when I was hearing your When Epics Fail video on aphorisms. So what is the and it reminded me, I go, I love aphorisms. I kind of speak in aphorisms, but but I remembered La Rochefoucauld going, okay, Book of Aphorisms, just way back finding in somebody's library, going, right, the deeply satisfying, even if they weren't always right, but that condensed, like, ooh.
And they weren't always right. La Rochefoucauld is one, I mean, La Rochefoucauld was Nietzsche's master, and then Nietzsche, of course, was many other people's master. But you had captured something, a truth, not the truth. Mm-hmm. And there was something about, again, this modesty of saying, this is merely a truth. I think where we find ourselves now is too many people are too certain of the truth. And that's unbecoming, and it prevents you from knowing. It's a kind of cynicism, really, and certainly a hubris that aphorisms are not guilty of, because aphorisms will say, this is what we know now. Now you riff off that.
Do you have a few?
I have plenty.
Oh, good. How chewy. Yeah, and then I want to weave in irony, but first
I'll start. Yes. And you interrupt me. So I'll just say very quickly that I grew up surrounded by proverbs. We speak in proverbs in Egypt. And I love them. And then I read, you know, Nietzsche and the others and Wilde and whoever and everyone else spoke in proverbs. Mm. Gubran. So here are a few aphorisms from Where Epics Fail. And you can tell me, you can pull a plug. Aphorisms respect the wisdom of silence by disturbing it, but briefly. Another one. Poems are like bodies. A fraction of their power resides in their skin. The rest belongs to the spirit that swims through them. Said a poem to a poet, can I trust you? Is your heart pure to carry me? Are your hands clean to pass me on? So this is the work. The clarifying of the heart, the purifying of the heart, the cleaning of the hands to pass the poem on. Another one. Unlike prose, poetry can keep its secrets.
That's great.
So yeah. So you tell me.
I want to interweave. I want you to come back to that. But this is all in your forthcoming book, Where Epics Fail. And I love also the experimental trickster nature of how you're publishing. Do tell our dedicated listeners how they can participate and how they can get a copy of your book and all of that, because it's all the book and its journey to become a book,
yeah,
both great.
It's very interesting. This is my seventh book, and it's the first time I've taken this route. It's a crowd-funded book, so it's a book that reminds the author to be humble and to recognize that readers, too, participate in the making of a book and in its realization and for it to thrive. It's with an English crowdfunding platform called Unbound. They call themselves, and I think they are, the world's first crowdfunding publisher. So they've got quite a respected background in traditional publishing with publishing houses, marketing, all of that, literary festivals. But what they do is they take on quirky books, books that others may not consider. And I've had offers for this book over the last 10 years, but I didn't feel they were quite right. I even had an offer the same day as Unbound accepted this book. So it's a kind of, I believe, with Terence, the Roman playwright, that books too have their destinies. I feel like it was destined to find its way there. And I'm lucky because in addition to giving readers this kind of flexibility, not readers, but also writers, obviously, the flexibility to make their books, they're backed by Penguin Random House, who are, of course, the biggest publishing house now, together, Penguin Random House, who go ahead and produce and distribute the book in its trade edition. So it's one of those fortunate best of both worlds situations. We get to make the book. The reader gets to express their interest in shaping it, and it's fully funded at this point and available for pre-order. And then at that point, it goes out into the world with, you know, a big giant that knows what to do with these things.
Wow. Yeah. And again, it's like speak to the part of everyone we want to dance, going, oh, you giant, lumbering, galumphing, you know, American but global publishing house, you know, here, do this thing.
Yeah.
And we'll do the creative thing. Well, that's intriguing in a great way. So does that mean over the aesthetics of the book and the cover and how it, the type, do you get creative?
They give you much more play than a traditional publisher would. The first edition of the book is hardcover. So they really value aesthetics, and they understand, because they work with, you know, they've done this kind of thing in the past. They understand giving, for example, aphorisms space to breathe on the page.
Right.
They don't want to crowd them. Yeah, and I was just very happy to know that I'm in good hands that way. So the first edition, which is, I want to say, around 400, possibly 500 books, they're hardcover, and they are the readers who have gone ahead. There's been nearly 300 readers now who have backed the book in about a month, which is terrific. So that goes to them. And then once that's done with, then Penguin Random House, the big friendly giant, put it in bookstores and do their thing with the paperback edition. And so I'm just, yeah, it means that I'm more in touch with my readers. I have a little bit more freedom, and I know that I'm working with sympathetic publishers.
So how can those of us already enthused, going, I must have this book, how can we pre-order, or how do we do that now?
If you have access to a computer, then you would type in Where Epics Fail, and possibly my name, Yahya Lababidi, or Unbound, or just Where Epics Fail and Lababidi, or something or other.
Yeah.
But there is a page that Unbound have where you can basically place a pre-order, and there's within... I don't know how much you want me to go into this, but for example, they have different ways to pledge. So within the first day, I had some person that I don't know, who's an English teacher, pledge, I don't know, nearly $3,000 because they believed in this project. It's things like that that sort of affirm the idea that you're not alone, that there's readers there who believe in that. And also PBS NewsHour was kind enough to cover it. So if you punch in PBS NewsHour or PBS and Where Epics Fail, then you can read about the book and then go on to pledge, being slightly more informed. And there's many ways.
Yeah. I'm glad we meet before I was daunted by your exoteric fame.
I wouldn't know what to do with it.
All right,
I wouldn't know what to do.
That's great. I wanted to tease you back into aphorisms, but also you know, just a toast to irony. I think of the ironic arts, the ironic sensibility, as particularly Middle Eastern. just the arched eyebrow, the seeing that somebody else is seeing. And I loved...
That's nice. The seeing someone else is seeing.
Yeah, ally in a glance, going, "Oh, you're seeing this story too. Yeah. We understand each other."
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah. Initiation in Sufism is a glance. The master initiates you with a glance.
That's really good. Because there was a great study some years back that I quote oft, that said, to the degree to which people are ironic is the degree to which they have the capacity for compassion.
Mm.
And I love it because it's unexpected, because we think of irony as kind of British bitter thing,
right,
as well as middle-aged. But to be ironic, we have to be holding at least two stories at once, what is, what should be, or what is and what people are pretending it is.
Detachment is necessary
in
seeing. I was thinking of Edward Said earlier, who was sort of able to straddle two cultures in an intelligent, mindful way. And he speaks of knowing your culture only through leaving your culture. And he speaks of the necessity of spiritual detachment and distance. And I think this is one of those things where you can apply it to you, whatever circumstance you like. If you have spiritual detachment and distance on your country, on whatever it is that you're so intimately, you feel is you, you tend to know it better and see it better and appreciate it in a way that you don't if you're up against the screen and trying to defend the indefensible.
Right. No, and I think that's part of the fairy tale journey. You have to leave home to find the treasure that
was
seeking the treasure, and then you return home discouraged, and then you go, what's that in the coals of my hearth? Oh, it's the treasure I was looking for all along. It was here. And that's kind of part of the Sky Earth story right now is, to venture forth and then come back to the treasure that was at home. When I said fooey to this country, Vietnam War, going, oh, terrible, stupid, colonial, just horrible America, and moved to England and in India for some time, but mostly England, and exploring every crank, crazy, esoteric cult possible. But after a while, I began to appreciate the kind of Henry James fresh American spirit of try stuff and openness, and everything can be excessive, but going, I began to go, oh, the anything can happen thing, the disruptive exoticism of the best of America, going, your old traditions, you it's why people in Sweden used to get so excited around Americans, going, are you allowed to do that and say that? And we go, yeah. So there's the good thing as well as the horrible thing, and
sure,
then to distill those. Yeah.
One of the things that drew me to you, oh fellow Libra, oh trickster you, is this sense of play. I take play very seriously, and I mean, I couldn't think of anything more serious in this setup that we're in. Come on, please. By this setup, I mean capital T, capital S, capital U. This setup, this world, this arrangement,
yes,
this being, you fill in the blanks. But I think of Thomas Merton, who I'm very taken by also, sort of as another, he would be, if I had a wall with masters, he'd be on that wall. And he talks about the tragic seriousness of wars, and how if we were to do things with a sense of play, we would dodge that. We wouldn't allow ourselves to quite go there. And of course, Nietzsche says this, and of course, everyone preceding Nietzsche who was ever concerned with the life of the spirit said this. This idea of the importance of play. Nietzsche's thing is the ideal he holds up is the child, the seriousness of a child at play. There's something profound to be had there. We would not allow ourselves, we all people, everywhere, would not allow ourselves so much missteps and indelicacy and, as my father-in-law says, que vulgaridad, such vulgarity, if we were to recognize the importance of play.
Yes, fabulous. in accord, oh spirit brother. Another spirit brother of mine, poet David Grimes, says, to access the innocent dignity of our child heart.
Yes, ma'am.
So it's part of, which we've dismissed as vulnerable. And we go, no, to have the savvy, you know, about the innocent dignity of the child heart, which sees...
The innocent dignity of the child heart.
Isn't that wonderful?
That's worth writing down.
It is worth writing down. Thank you, David Grimes. We love attribution as well, oh, modern world. Oh, we do, because it keeps the story intact. So, yeah, so the innocent dignity of the child heart, which, you know, When Angela's Ashes, an important person, Frank McCourt, wrote Angela's Ashes, he said that he had to rewrite the narrative three times because it's such a sad story. The first two narrators were too bitter and it was unreadable. He had to find the innocent dignity of his child heart as the guide. And that's the trickster guide, which sees everything and is a detached participant in some way. You know?
That's very important. I have an aphorism. I can't. I'm going to misquote it because I don't remember these things exactly.
Even though you wrote it.
Never mind. Oh. I remember I didn't.
Oh, you didn't write it.
No,
okay.
I was just there.
But we still attribute.
Yes. Why so, not?
Oh, yes.
Why not?
Okay.
As a courtesy. But it goes something like this. And if our hearts should harden and turn to ice, we must at least not blame the weather.
Hmm.
This notion of bitterness.
Bitterness
is failure. Misanthropy is failure. I mean, there are no failures but misanthropes. So this notion of, at the very least, whatever you've been through, and again, I go back to this lecture of yours that I saw this morning, which I can't remember, but you were very good at swatting away all the whininess that we all are capable of and we all, you know, indulge in. And you said, and then you sort of, you know, moved past that self-indulgence, that sentimentality to something else. So we must care for our hearts, and part of caring for our hearts is not blaming the weather and not allowing them to turn hard and turn to ice.
Well, and yes, relating as though any part, as though we were not contributing creative complicity to anything in front of us, you know, going, and therefore the freedom to choose, but to acknowledge whatever's going on, we are contributing to that thing. So the yearning again. See, it's the idea of the yearning. You know, allows us to not be snookered by the particulars, but fully informed. You know, again, the Hermes precision of Virgo, Virgo and Pisces or Neptune, Mercury and Neptune, mysticism and intellect, you know, love each other. These are false divisions.
Nice. Very right? Nice.
And so for everybody, and again, yeah, and they're suffused, you know, I like, you know, linguistic precision guides the vision is the Virgo. Our moons are in Virgo there kind of thing. So, yeah, so maybe another aphorism that's so tasty.
Sure. So to write is to bow, is to pray. Another one. There are many ways to donate blood. Writing is one. Yet another. To acquire a third eye, one cannot blink. And I mean, these are, one way of my defining these aphorisms to myself at least, is to say that they're what's worth quoting from the soul's dialogue with itself. We go around all day, we're talking to ourselves, we read, we're moved, we're frisson in French is when something rubs against you and tickles you to your essence somehow. And then at some point you have something to say. And I think that's what these aphorisms are. And I remember when I first read them to my wife, who's not a literary person, who's out in the garden somewhere, coughing. She says, she thought I'd left the house, and she was speaking to her sister, and she says, oh, so that's what aphorisms are. They're kind of the thoughts that we have already, but we don't quite know how to put into words. That was wonderful. My ego was wounded to hear that because I thought, this was mine. Because I was still young, 10 years earlier. But at the same time, I thought there's something very humbling about, oh, these are the thoughts we all have, but we don't quite have the words for them.
But I loved you putting together aphorisms and proverbs. Again, we love the concise, chewy thing we can take in and, you know, dine on. So when did aphorisms begin? I mean, are proverbs and aphorisms always dancing through time?
That's a good question. I mean, a proverb is an aphorism that's lost its name tag. In most cases, I mean, unless you're talking about religious proverbs, because proverbs are.
That's what I mostly think of. But
well, no, where I grew up, everybody speaks in proverbs.
So it's Mullah Nasruddin. It's the Sufi story.
Sure, if you like, but it's not even that. It's also my grandmother's.
Well, like what is
that? Naim ala sadrahu bifakar fa ghadraha. He's sleeping on her breast, and he's already plotting to deceive her.
Oh,
and they usually rhyme.
That's a little
racy. That was my racy grandmother. Both grandmothers, my maternal one from Egypt, my paternal one from Lebanon, Palestine, who's still alive, she's in her 90s, spoke almost exclusively in Proverbs, in these sing-song, witty, wise sayings.
Right.
And I grew up listening to, and I was enamored by these. And my mom sometimes would transcribe them to me, or I would get books where I'd have them in English and Arabic.
But they can be modern.
They were exclusively modern. They were not religious. They were not spiritual.
In the last 100 years, or 10 years ago, or, I mean,
further back than that.
Right.
But it was understood that this was sort of our oral history, our street philosophy, our street poetry. And it was, you could be unschooled. In fact, there's another one. العلم في الراس مش في الكراس. Knowledge is what's in your head, not what's in your notebooks, and it rhymes in Arabic.
Mm.
Because they were illiterate. You know, over 50% of Egyptians were illiterate when I was there. Of course, the government would have you believe it was, you know, much less than that, but I knew it was probably more than that even.
We are drawing to a close,
yes,
this is a fun cavort, perhaps the first of many.
Mm.
But is there a proverb or a blessing you'd like to waft out there to the world of, you know, you can think about that for about 10 seconds. And so meanwhile, I will do the thank yous to Erica Bridgman in Berkeley. Thank you so much for being such a great board op. And I am my own board op here in Washington, D.C., Caroline Casey from the Coyote Witchery, with the first honored in-person guest here, who is a wonderful, perfect, good sport, Yahia Labavidi, Egyptian-American poet. His forthcoming book, Where Epics Fail, you can just do a search and it will come up, and there we have it. So thank you so much, Yahya.
Thank you. I have two aphorisms to close with.
Okay.
We can lend ideas our breath, but ideals require our entire lives.
That's it. That's all we have time for.
And
we're out, and we'll reconvene next week with John Curaçao, a wonderful
Excellent.
Ally.
Excellent.
Okay. Woof, woof, woof. Thank you, team.